All chickens are Catholic, Tom. Sorry.
Oh, oh my bad. Wait, can America. Chickens cry? Can chickens?
They do when they see me.
And we're live. Welcome back to the Loopcast. I am joined today by Erica and Josh Mercer. Big timing is over. You were at a conference over the weekend, and I believe you were signing some autographs. Is that correct?
Just one autograph, I guess. It was very, very nice. I don't know why no one would want my autograph. Usually it's just a bank that wants my autograph.
So, yeah, did you enjoy your time out there? I know it was a papal artifacts conference out in Minnesota. What was the coolest artifact you saw?
I mean, there's lots of different things. I mean, for example, Father Rich Kuntz is just a total history buff and history nerd, and I love it. And he's very creative. So one of the things that he did, he got the signature from Sister Lucia, one of the three Fatima children. How did he do it? Right. Well, there was a nun from that community, because it's a cloister convent, so they don't normally leave. They send one sister out to get supplies or whatever they might need. And he comes up to her and says, I want to help Sister Lucia's work. Here's a donation. And so she took the check, and Sister Lucia signs the back of the check, and he gets the check back. He gets the signature.
It has her signature.
Wow.
Guys, that's just a genius. I like the way he thinks.
Gotta give him credit for that. Yeah.
That's right.
That's some moxie, you know?
Yeah. And we had some Pawn Stars members out there for any fans of the history program. It was an expert that was on there, right? And he's been on the show too.
Like, it's one of the main guys on the show. Like, when they call in the history expert from the Clark County, Nevada History Museum, he comes on the show and tells them, you know, whether or not, oh, that's authentic or not. He doesn't tell them what the price is, but he says, yeah, that really does look like a Civil War, you know, uniform or whatever it is. And he would get, the show came to him and said, well, we got some stuff, some papal artifacts. What is, you know, what it was a skull cap of Pope Leo XIII. And he's like, I don't even know. What do I do? And so he researches and he finds Father Rich Kuntz. And Father Rich has been on the show a few times. So it's just kind of neat to hear some of these stories.
Yeah, definitely.
I would encourage people to go to check out VaticanUnveiled.com. It's just a lot of really neat stuff.
You get to go to Duluth.
It's the second largest collection of people out of artifacts.
Outside of Rome.
Outside
correct?
Of Rome, yeah. I mean, Vatican's number one, obviously.
Yeah.
After that, it's Duluth, Minnesota.
Duluth, Minnesota. Land of chainsaws, overalls, and papal artifacts.
That's right. Yeah. It was kind of nice to have, you know, the loop in Duluth.
The loop.
Yeah. And speaking of the loop, I know one story that just completely popped off the sheet. So as of Wednesday, President Biden announced the details of his student loan cancellation plan. And I think it's helpful for context because it's very confusing, the mechanics of all of it, but here are some of the basics. It would relieve $10,000 in student loans per borrower earning under $125,000, as well as $20,000 per borrower for people who paid for college using Pell Grants. It's extending the pause on federal student loan repayment, again, to January 2023, and it's nixing $10,000 of debt per borrower. This would cost $298 billion in 2022 and a total of $329 billion by 2031, if the policy is renewed each year. I don't know if you can do this, basically. Mercer, do you have any insight on this? Can you just wave a pen and forgive this debt?
No, I mean, if Congress wanted to do something, which of course Democrats control both the House and the Senate, they could pass a law, you know, alleviating some of this debt. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, even in April, said this is totally unconstitutional. The president doesn't have the authority to just single-handedly make up laws and make up rules on all these loans for these college students. So I absolutely think it's going to go to the courts, and I think it's going to be completely invalidated.
Right.
Because it's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
It is. And I think that's part of the, because obviously there's all of the arguments that are just logic, common sense, you know, why forgive the debt for these students who went to these top schools and got gender studies degrees? Why not, you know, the guy who just cut down all the trees in our front yard, who just got out of high school, took out a loan to buy some trucks, you know, why not him, who actually went in and did useful things for the world? But aside from all of those arguments about just the injustice of it to people who have not gone to college and taken on debt they can't repay. This is actually because President Biden is fully aware that this is not a legal move. It is not something that is within the scope of the presidential, the executive arm of government. He knows it's going to go to the courts. He knows that this kind of thing belongs to the powers of Congress. And so it's just another way of eating away at our democracy and doing its political theater, hoping to get a bump in the midterms pretty clearly, right?
Right. And the frustration is, I mean, college is too expensive right now. I agree with that. And I do think the system we have in place right now is completely broken and flawed.
Yes.
Part of the reason is too many people are going to college that don't necessarily even need it. And we know that because so many of them drop out every year. But all, you know, we need to come up with a better way of doing this. And I think the easy availability of government-backed loans for college has created a situation culturally where everyone thinks they have to do this in order to succeed and get a, and a, to get a good job, which is Mike Rowe of, he's been, made the point that there's a lot of skilled labor jobs that don't require college education. You can make a great living, have a great life that way. You don't have to do a four-track college, you know, not everyone's meant to be in a four-year college prep. And so I do think the easy availability of government loans has ballooned the prices. If you look at things, why are certain segments of the American economy over time that the price kind of gets lower? I mean, when my mom and dad bought a big TV, you know, in the 1980s, it was like, you know, $1,600 and it was like, that would be the equivalent of like $5,000 now, right? I mean, it was a major purchase, right? Well, I can go to Walmart right now and buy one for like $300, just about the same size. And it's obviously a lot better. Now, that's replicated in industry after industry, like telephones, all these other things. Look at the segments of the American economy, though, that have continuously gotten more and more expensive. College education, healthcare, these are ones where government has said, oh, we need to help out by pumping all this money into it and help people. What ends up happening is the price goes right up. This is exactly what happened when Biden said, we're going to give, you know, pass this inflation bill, right, to fight inflation. It gave $7,500 to people who want to, as a tax credit, to buy these, you know, electric cars. And as soon as they did that, Ford jumped the price up $7,500. Like, you know, so what do you think these colleges are doing? Like, you know, we're seeing practically double-digit inflation on college every year before all this recent inflation stuff, because they know, just get whatever loan you want. Uncle Sam's going to pay for it. You're not going to, and you're, if you're 18, you're like, oh, I'll have to pay this back when I'm like 26. That feels like forever. It's a bad system. We should try to change it. I think the best thing to do would get the government out of the loan business. Stop college loans. It sounds like, how could you do that? Don't you care? I mean, these universities have endowments that are like, I mean, Harvard's got an endowment larger than probably the economies of half the countries in Europe. It's crazy.
And it's true.
They're, you know, these universities are like hedge funds that teach classes. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And it's, I think the problem with the system is that it's rewarding everything that the Democratic Party has traditionally said that they're against. I mean, they're like the Workers' Party, the party of the poor. But this kind of a move by the Democrats, it's rewarding irresponsible borrowing.
It's totally rewarding upper middle class suburbanites. Right.
Yes, it's rewarding middle upper middle class urbanites, exactly, who go on to study things like genders and women's and what have you.
If you wanted to help the poor, why would you just say we're going to eliminate $10,000 of everyone's college debt? I mean, credit card debt. That would be so much more progressive, like true progressive, helping the poor. Like that would be amazing, right? Why wouldn't they do that? That doesn't help them in November as much, I suppose.
So that's interesting. So, because this can't be done, and if it is done, it's so devastating. I mean, even Obama's ex-policy advisor has said, why are we dumping gasoline on the fire here? Inflation's bad enough. Why are we just going to forgive all this money? It seems to me like a political play. He knows he can't do it, and then when it gets shot down, he's going to blame the people that stopped it. Do you think it'll be an effective one? Do you think this – because I think the logic of it makes people so mad who have paid for college, who have done it the right way. And it actually only is helping such a small percentage of people. Most of these people are like graduate students who are just caked in debt anyway. So it doesn't seem like it's really speaking to the main population. So I guess, Erica, do you think that this will be an effective midterm strategy for them? or will it backfire?
Yeah, I mean, I hope not. The people it's going to speak to are people who I believe are already in his back pocket. They're already going to vote Democrat. They're not wondering, gosh, should I go for the Republican or should I go for the Democrat? They're already in the pocket. I also think it's dangerous to be rewarding people with sort of a welfare mentality, because if you keep building up this population of your supporters, of your voter base, with this practice of, we're just going to take care of you and pay off your stuff, you're not going to get people who will get out there and fight for you and actually be fighting for something. I've been very wrong before when it comes to election outcomes.
Well, actually, I think it might help them. I mean, from a pure political thing, I do think it's going to probably help Biden and the Democrats, because, you know, They're on offense right now when it comes to abortion. They love abortion. They're frustrated that Roe v. Wade got overturned. And so this gives them something that they're happy about to push for. So, you know, we got the student loan $10,000 wiped out, and Biden's fighting back on Roe v. Wade. And I do think, I mean, you have to remember, when it comes to coalition politics, you need to try to help out the people that elected you. So this is from a political 101, this is very smart for Biden. Even if it's not good for the country, it's good for his political party. I do think it'll help him, unfortunately, because I think his party's been disastrous for the last 2 years.
Mercer, too, if you could explain, too, the mechanism in which he's using. I mean, I got a kick out of this. The technical way, it has to do with some type of 9/11 era emergency power, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it was passed passed right after 9/11. It was intended to help members of, I think it was intended to help members of the, was the military help become police officers, or the other way around. But in other words, it had to do with coming up with a response in terms of the national security issues that we had in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. It wasn't like, oh, hopefully this will be used in 10 years to make sure that, you know, graduates of Harvard University don't have to pay $10,000 in college debt. I mean, you know, I would imagine the 9/11 families would be pretty upset about this. I mean, it strikes me as just another.
But the emergency that they're talking about is COVID-19.
Well, right. It says in the law, national emergency. And so the national emergency they're invoking is the one that we're pretty much over with.
Right. Not the recession that we aren't having. So,
this is political games that everyone gets mad about, right? This is not in the letter, not in the spirit of what that was made for.
But see, now President Biden isn't alleviating mortgage debt. He isn't alleviating debt for credit cards. He's picking college debt, which is, again, we're disproportionately talking about a welfare transfer payment from plumbers and electricians to lawyers and doctors. It's the nurse paying off the debt of the doctor. It's insane.
We'll see where that takes us. I honestly have no idea where that's going to go. I'm sure it'll get struck down in a court, but.
Before November.
Probably not before November, and that's what they're definitely.
I'll take that bet. I say it gets. Ah. They put a hold on this before the elections.
Okay.
So I don't think it gets fully struck down, but I think we're going to see a national injunction on this within a few weeks.
And they'll blame the Republicans.
I think that's a safe bet.
So speaking of safe bets, you know, Catholics, they like to get married, and our Loop audience. Very much enjoyed our article on 10 concrete ways to improve your marriage that we included in the Loop. It was one of the most clicked on articles. And I'm such a sucker for these. Anytime you just say there's 10 things of something that I'm related to.
Like I click. Can digest that click.
Yep. Well played on their behalf. But I think now's a good time for us to go a little round table here. When you guys read this article, what really spoke to you? And would you add an 11th if you could? Erica, I'll start with you.
Well, so my favorite is one that was number 5. So renew your honeymoon. For those of you who haven't read it, it talks about renewing your honeymoon and working constantly on communication skills, having a date night at least once a month. And that's some advice that an older couple gave to my husband and I before we got married almost 20 years ago. And it's something we really took to heart. So we've been blessed with 6 children. There's been a lot of ups and downs health-wise. Our income status has fluctuated quite a lot. But we've always tried to commit to that monthly date night and just focusing on our relationship, even not like before the kids, because sometimes they're up before me in the morning, so you have to focus on them, but just prioritizing our relationship as the foundation of the home.
Concrete question for you. As you said, your income has fluctuated.
Way up and down.
That happens to everyone at some point in life. Yeah. Do you have any, what's your best, like really cheap, you know, low cost, no cost date night that you've done?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So we would just drive out to, when we lived closer to the coast, we would just drive to the state park and walk along the Long Island Sound beach. That's zero cost except for the gas. We could even like pack some granola bars, a couple of Gatorades, maybe a bottle of something stronger, and just take a walk on the beach and just get out of the house, right? Get out of the house. And we've done a lot too, where, you know, with all the children before our kids could babysit themselves, just talking around the parish. I mean, making connections in the parish so we could share babysitting with other couples, drop our kids off at someone's house, and just going out of our way to make that effort to have some alone time together, especially when the kids were younger. Really important.
Yeah, I call that vestibule politicking. You know, that's where you make all the connections.
Hey, that's fancy.
Like, hey, you got some kids. Hey, I got some kids.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make something work here, you know? Try to get out of the house a little bit, enjoy the company of the spouse.
You look functional. I look functional. Right. I'll leave my baby with you.
What could go wrong?
Mercer, on to you. What really spoke to you? What's worked for you guys in marriage?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the rules he laid out, most of them, like the first nine actually, are simple, good rules for really any number of people that have to be together. So, it says prayer, forgiveness, controlling anger, acts of kindness, obviously not renew honeymoon, but most of these things are just, in general, lessons that anyone can learn, married or single. It could be, half of these apply just to your work environment even. You know what I'm saying? It's like treating someone else with respect, you know, being forgiving, don't be so angry, frequent compliments. The one that is obviously, you know, in terms of, you know, like then you start getting towards family life in more detail, and he talks about a monthly family day of retreat. That, you know, that's something, okay, that's a good idea. I should try that. And the last one is be a good Samaritan to your spouse and to others. And this is the thing, so much of this marriage advice, I mean, there's practical marriage advice. I always, you know, if I were talking to somebody who wasn't even Catholic, you know, what advice would you give someone just getting married? I'd say, make sure you're on the same page with kids and on the same page with spending, debt kind of stuff. You know, those are two massive things. But when it comes to trying to talk about Catholics as well, but you can still even address it to secular, being a good Samaritan, because ultimately everything in life, if you're sacrificial, it's a stronger relationship. And so if you put the interests of your spouse first and your family first, mm-hmm. not that you're depleting yourself, but you end up becoming more satisfied because God created us to serve others. And if you do that, you will be rewarded. We know this every time, you know, you volunteer for an important cause down at the church or a soup kitchen or something like that. When you do that, you just feel better. And if you can move away from marriage as being two buddies that have a bucket list that live in the same place to, into something where, you know, it's greater than you and your spouse combined. Yeah. It's, you know, we're on a mission. We're trying to get each other's souls to heaven, our children's souls to heaven, and to be good neighbors and good citizens. And that comes from a humility. Humility is the hardest thing, but it's a critical and essential ingredient.
I agree. And you made such a good point. Suffering is not a bug in the you know, this life we live. It's a feature. And Catholicism is one of the few religions that I think has really owned suffering as the path to salvation. And so one thing with marriage, at least I've observed, is when suffering comes around, it's not like, oh my gosh, something's wrong. You know, it's not like I'm freaking out because suffering exists. It's, oh, suffering's always existed. And marriage is just a new avenue in which I'm experiencing that. And if you can own that and use that as a means to offer it up for salvation, then all of a sudden it becomes like you feel more purpose in it and there's less hopelessness. And to your point, you feel a lot better.
It's just like church. If you know, when you're a teenager, a lot of times you're like, mom, dad, why do I have to go to church? What am I getting out of it? Right. And too many people who get married have that same approach. What am I getting out of this marriage? It's like, mm-hmm. stop it. You're looking at it all wrong. If a 13-year-old kid said that about mass, you'd be like, get over it. It's about more than just you. You are there so that to worship God, because it is a good thing to do. And if you get something out of it, that's great. You know, but sometimes, some days you're there at church and you're not going to get, quote, anything out of it. But mm-hmm. let me tell you something. We're a mystical body of Christ, right? And so one time my wife was with our fifth child, Johnny, up at the hospital, and I had to take the other four kids to church. And, you know, they were like all tiny. I mean, the oldest was like 5 years old, 5, 4, 3. I mean, it's crazy, right? And I go to mass, I get done, you know, I'm just like, be quiet, be good. They'll buy donuts, it'll be good. Go to McDonald's or something. And I'm leaving, and there's my friend John. He's like he's about 30 years older than me. He looks at me and just looks at me, stops for a second. Josh, you are my hero. I'm like laughing, like, what are you talking about? You took all four kids to church on your own? I mean, it's what I'm supposed to do, you know? And he's just like, you're a great dad. I'm like, well, I don't know about that, but I play one on TV, so we'll see. But I mean, it's understanding, you know, is it only about what you get out of it? Sometimes mm-hmm. you're not going to get something out of it. So our culture that keeps emphasizing your own personal fulfillment, happiness, or pleasure is such a misguided thing. Like, that doesn't mean I'm in favor of not having fun ever. No, it's just like, that shouldn't be the only thing. It shouldn't be the top thing, right? I mean, it's
that you're like, what we're seeing is that the reality of what we are as human persons is that in order for us to be fulfilled and to be happy, we can't be living for ourselves. And the more we try and grasp at this marriage will make me happy, this is my life partner, this is my soulmate, the more we grasp at that and turn marriage into self-fulfillment for me, the less we're going to lose it. It's going to escape from us. And I think it's really important for Catholic families and marriages, because, you know, when you're in the, like you're saying, Josh, like when you're in the trenches and you're like, I got to get the kids to mass and my wife's not here, or, you know, we've been fighting with viruses all summer. Like, so when I read the Good Samaritan thing, I'm like, yeah, my husband did look like a man lying half dead on the roadside just the other day. And I had to go bring him some, you know, chicken broth or something. But that kind of work, it does produce great fruit in the church. And I can't tell you how many times, like you said, the guy coming up to you and being like, you're my hero, or, you know, we've been going to our parish for 11 years now, and we have students coming back who are now married saying, well, we would see you guys with all your kids in the front row of mass and think, oh, that's so inspiring. And I'm thinking, all I hear in mass in the front row is, be quiet, sit down. Like, you gotta listen to Father, stop hitting her. No, you can't dump the water. You know, that's my experience of mass. But just by being faithful and doing the hard thing and not being totally self-centered about it, you are feeding the body of Christ. And there are so few happy families and marriages in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our country, that if you can, you know, just pursue a beautiful Christian marriage and take practical steps like the ones in this article, you really do bless the world, even if you don't feel it all the time yourself. And you do, you end up being happier because it wasn't about you.
And the amount of time I spend on this recommendation will reflect the amount of time I've been married relative to the people here. I've only been married about 2 years. It'll be about 2 years coming up.
Your humility does you credit, Fogo.
Ugh, well, I don't know about that. I'm trying, man. I'm trying. So for me, someone gave me this advice and it really changed my relationship for the better. Have a weekly meeting with your spouse. The meeting is very specific, though. One person goes, they talk for like 10 to 15 minutes with nothing said by the other person, nothing, just silence. You can nod if you want. You just talk exactly what you're feeling, exactly how you're feeling it, let it out. And then that person can only respond with, thank you for telling me, I will try to do better on X, Y, and Z. That's it. You can't give any rebuttals. You can't this and that. And then you get your 15 minutes. You can say everything. And that's the only response you can get. After both people have shared, you kind of have that breakdown. But I just realized after doing that how many times my wife would be saying something to me, and I'm already in my head working on all my rebuttals that I'm going to hit her with. I've just said, well, I was doing this, well, I was doing that. Whatever. It doesn't matter, right? That's not the point. The point of this is to make sure that you can hear the other person and you validate the way that they're feeling and that you're truly listening to them. And they do the same thing back, because true listening isn't waiting for a rebuttal. It's actually listening to and understanding where they're coming from and what they're feeling. And then we always feel better after. I don't know how to describe it. It's like just you have the experience of feeling heard. I think a lot of people seek that. And just because you get married doesn't mean that should stop, you know? So really structured time. We do it on Wednesdays. You can choose whatever day you want, whatever time you can get away. I'm young in marriage, so maybe that'll change, but I want to keep doing that.
That sounds amazing that you can do that.
I don't have as many kids as you guys, so
I hope Todd doesn't listen to this. Though. Yeah, I am. I am fascinated by that.
So, like, I mean, for me, what works for my spouse is that she'll tell me what I'm doing wrong, and I say, okay, and then that's pretty much it. But she doesn't like. She's like, you work in politics. You argue for a living. I don't like arguing with you. So, oh, okay. So,
yeah, that's
maybe
fair.
Maybe I can write it down and she can look at it when she has time, right?
There you go, yeah. Because sometimes different people need different amounts of time to formulate their thoughts. One of the hardest things for us was I have instant opinions. I have instant thoughts. I could tell you exactly how I feel about this.
Well,
oh my gosh, yeah.
So, and she can't.
Maybe my wife would like the same thing you're talking about, because she'd be able to talk for 15 minutes and I wouldn't be able to rebut it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
No rebuttal. She would love that.
Yeah.
It's hard to. So one of the things that we struggle with, my husband has total auditory recall, which means that he can remember whole conversations from like years ago. I have almost none. Like I couldn't even tell you what I said 5 minutes
That's
ago
awesome.
On this podcast, but it's very like difficult when we're arguing.
Of the stereotypical gender thing, right?
I know. It is. We're very, yeah. Well, and he also like, he formulates more slowly and I'm just like out of the gate. And yeah, so I think every marriage, like over time you get to know each other. And part of the beauty of the vows is like, you're stuck with it. So figure it out. But it really like works. It wears you down. I don't want to sound flippant, because some people really have to.
You hit on such an important thing. You are stuck with it, but it's not that you're stuck with it. You chose it.
You chose it. Like, decision. I committed till you're dead or I'm dead.
Correct. Yep. Till you're dead or I'm dead. So it's like, well, we're not going anywhere. We better figure this out. It's not like I could just say, oh, I'm done with this. I'm about to go.
Exactly.
On to the next.
Yeah. And we were blessed to get married pretty young too. I know we're running out of time on this segment, but I have to say we were blessed to get married really young. I was right out of college. He was 2 years out. And one of the greatest encouragements I got from a professor who, you know, everyone else is like, oh, on your career, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, but I really just love this guy. And the professor was like, the great thing about getting married young is you get to finish growing up together. And I think that's sort of true whenever, whatever age you get married, eventually you have to grow together and sort of finish maturing together. And that togetherness is, it becomes more beautiful and it's hard and it requires that humility. And we have rough patches like everybody else, but the fruit of it is so beautiful and worthwhile. And it's only explainable by grace. Like, let's just be real. Sacramental grace, people.
Yeah.
Totally relying on that.
No, that's a good insight, though.
All right. Today, I'm talking to Catholic Vote's DC lobbyist, Tom McCluskey. Tom.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Yeah, of course. It's been a long time since the CV retreat, so I'm always happy to touch base with our expert. We're now in the post-Roe world, and as someone who's been very involved in the pro-life movement, the war has kind of moved to the states. And so now that we're in the states, I hear the phrase trigger laws quite a bit. For the layman, there's a lot of legal battles going on right now. Can you please just explain what a trigger law is and where are we seeing it
right
now?
And I've been involved in the DC movement for decades. I've always seen it as kind of, I think it's a tale from Denmark or Holland of the little boy who puts his finger in the dike. That's DC. The actual work has always been done in the states. And one of the things that a number of states did that even despite Roe v. Wade, they knew that one day Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned. So they would pass laws that would include phrases such as when Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton is overturned, this is what the state law will be. And we're seeing the fruits of that today. Instead of having to go to those states and pass laws, which could take a couple of years, those states had the foresightedness of wanting to pass laws that are triggered by the fall of Roe. And now we're going to see this week on the 24th, Tennessee, Idaho, and Texas become some of the most pro-life states in the union because of things like these trigger laws.
Yeah, and just for perspective, how many lives has estimates said that this could save?
I think SBA lists like crunch the numbers, and the Charlotte Lejeune Institute which is a branch of SBA lists, is really, really our powerhouse when it comes to numbers like that. And they've said it's around 69,000-70,000. Having worked in DC for a long time, I think estimates are usually pretty far off. So I'm optimistic it'll probably be even more. And of course, every life saved is a future generation. Every life saved touches more lives, and that 69,000, I think, changed the world.
And one thing that I've noticed as well is the Biden administration has really done everything possible to get behind a bullhorn and say, we disagree with the Supreme Court decision. We believe that abortion should be available in all 50 states at all times for any reason, and have really struggled with making that happen in legislation. So since the decision, what have they done to accomplish that through their agencies or through laws that they've tried to pass? What are we seeing their plan of attack is right now?
Well, they were planning for this, and I was starting to get worried because we saw internal memos from the Biden administration that showed, they're really planning for this. Whereas for us, we're looking at, okay, now we have 50 fights to fight, and nobody, it's not that we were unprepared, except nobody can be ready and predict what's going to happen after Roe fell. And except now that Roe has fallen, what we've seen is the Biden administration is just as incompetent as everybody thought. A lot of what they're doing is throwing spaghetti up against the wall. But there are certain things that when you throw spaghetti up against the wall, stick. One of those things is the work they're doing around the abortion pill, chemical abortions. That is the biggest threat probably out there right now. They're accountable for 54% of abortions. When you narrow it down to like in Chicago, they're accountable for 80% of abortions. And these are things where you need the federal government to get involved because they're sent through the mail and they're very dangerous. Babies are definitely dying, but women are also being permanently injured and dying. One other thing they've been doing is lawsuits. And we're seeing that in one of the states, Idaho, and in Texas, they're using a law called EMTALA. And please don't ask me what EMTALA stands for, but it's to protect people that you have to be treated. If you're injured and you go to the hospital, you have to be treated. The Biden administration is trying to bastardize this by saying, if you go to the hospital and you're pregnant, the hospital has to abort that child if that's what you request. That's completely reverse what EMTALA. EMTALA actually mentions protecting the unborn four times. It doesn't mention abortion once. And we've already seen an injunction in Texas stopping the Biden administration. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see something similar in Idaho, even though they're known for having more liberal court, infamous Ninth Circuit. So except the Biden administration is willing to throw anything it can to try to preserve this false dichotomy of abortion. And they're willing to use federal taxpayer dollars and federal resources and intimidation to get it done.
Yeah, and it's nice to hear that like quick hit of common sense won out, right? Because whatever they're calling upon there deep in the legislation clearly is not the intent. It just feels like such bad faith. And for all the non-policy wonks and non-politic heads out there, we included in the loop a lot. It's state judge blocks X or Biden Justice Department sues X. So can you just explain the process of, so there's a law and the federal government wants to get involved. What does that process look like? Where do they pick the fight? And then how does that work out mechanically?
Over the decades, there are certain organizations like Judicial Crisis Network with Carrie Severino that their heart and soul is trying to find good judges that will uphold the Constitution. Because what they've seen for decades, and we've seen it on the Supreme Court level with people like from people appointed both by Democrats and Republicans, from Justice Ginsburg to David Souter, that it's more they interpret the law to the times as opposed to what the law actually meant and what the Constitution actually means. So a lot of these judges at lower levels, they don't look to the Constitution. They look more to their gut. And that's not what the court system is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about the laws that are written. And that's why we won in Texas on this EMTALA lawsuit, at least temporarily, and why there is a chance we might lose in, say, the Ninth Circuit, because there's something called judge shopping. The other side does this where they try to find where there might be more liberal judges. And the Ninth Circuit, which covers Idaho and California and Oregon and Washington states, and I think parts of Montana, is known as a very liberal court. And it's why when Donald Trump was in, he nominated and we got confirmed hundreds of judges to help change generationally to allow the legislatures, state legislatures, to do what they need to do. And it's one reason why Joe Biden, he's trying to do the same legacy and nominate hundreds of judges.
Yeah, and interestingly about the judge shopping, did that apply in the case of Mississippi v. Dobbs, where they specifically chose that because they thought the judges would be sympathetic to getting it up to the Supreme Court eventually?
Well, Mississippi, as you can probably imagine, is in a pretty conservative court district as well. I can't remember what the number is. So it was mostly Providence, but then it gets to the Supreme Court and it was stagnant for a year or so. And while this wasn't exactly judge shopping, it wasn't really fully accepted until after Justice Ginsburg passed away and Amy Coney Barrett became judge, that the other justices, at least five of them, said, yeah, we'll hear this case now. So it was really prudential. Nobody thought a year ago on this date that Roe v. Wade would no longer exist a year later. Yeah, here we are.
Yeah, and so the strategy on that one was it would be so devastating to the cause to hear this before we feel like we actually have the potential to strike down Roe v. Wade to implement pro-life protections.
But Mississippi also showed us that that sometimes when you do the right thing happens. That's why I've always been cautious. Past pro-life strategists like to say, like, they try to build the pro-life strategy around what the current makeup of the Supreme Court was. If you look at your history, if that tactic was taken with separate but equal and Plessy versus Ferguson, which eventually Brown versus Board of Education overruled, then we would still have separate but equal today. It's a matter of sometimes you just got to put faith in what you're doing is right. And in this case, Mississippi did that. Mississippi did change. The original intent was to uphold a 14-week ban. They did change their underlying brief to make sure that to instead target Roe v. Wade directly once they saw the makeup of the court change.
Hmm. Interesting. So it's like, how much can we get away with
in it? In a sense, in our line of work, it's how many babies can we save? So that's a good target to have.
Yeah, right. It's not semantics. In your perspective as an expert, did you see it as a true underdog story? Like, people really didn't think that this would eventually rise to strike down Roe v. Wade? Or was that case specifically from the very beginning thought of, oh yeah, we could do this here and we have a
good chance? I see it very much as an underdog story. There weren't a lot of national groups that were thrilled about the Mississippi law, but Mississippi decided this is what's right for our state. There were national groups also and national legal experts. That's what, when you throw around the word expert, that's what everybody in D.C. calls themselves. But we're guessing just as much as the next guy. And there are a lot of legal experts in D.C. who told Mississippi, no, 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 please, this isn't the right thing to do.
And just for clarification, what was the Mississippi law?
The Mississippi law was what is called a 15-week. That's by the time the tribunal, some say it's even at 12 weeks, but this was arbitrarily landed at 15, of when a baby can feel pain. And it's part of an incremental strategy. 15-week heartbeat is more about 5 or 6 weeks. A lot of the strategy is about what the courts would accept and what they would not accept. And the 15-week turned into a save all babies strategy once the Supreme Court had shifted. And kudos to the Mississippi legal team and the attorney down there, Finch and others who decided that we're going to go for the brass ring to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. And so post Roe, we're looking forward. What is next on the horizon for the pro-life movement? What should we be paying attention to?
I think chemical abortions is the one thing, at least on the national level. Me personally, I think that we need to, on the national level, because say Texas wins, and the first thing that happens is the other side, like Planned Parenthood of Texas, files a lawsuit. Who is giving money to Planned Parenthood? We are, to the tune of $500 million a year. We need to stop that funding stream on the national level. And when it comes to the states, it's going to be a 50-state type thing. We have about 13 states that I think once we go through these initial rounds of lawsuits, it's going to be those states are going to be ones to watch, except also hopefully that we'll learn lessons from them, because it's about making abortion unthinkable. And one of the steps in doing that, instead of just abortion being illegal, we want to make it unthinkable. And one of the steps is to make sure that when women and families find themselves in situations, that they know there are other options out there. There are options to help them, both financially and physically, as well as there are noble options like adoption to also help. And what the states do to help promote that, I think, will be very important. And what we do as a church.
Yeah, definitely. And that's where hopefully Catholic Vote and the laity step in. And we see things like pregnancy resource centers, just providing counseling, things as simple as diapers, just help for women in these tough situations. Right. It's an embodiment of the pro-life message, right? It's not just pro-birth. Pro-life means comprehensive, and comprehensive care means taking care of the mother and the baby, and not just eliminating one of those
right.
people.
And what I mentioned before about Providence playing such a huge part in Mississippi and overturning Roe, it's a Providence that had a very heavy human hand in it as well, because of the efforts of things like 40 Days for Life and just prayer in general, and the Pregnancy Resource Center showing the softer side of the pro-life movement. They've been there for decades. And only now Elizabeth Warren is discovering them and wants to shut them down, the senator from Massachusetts. And in addition, it's the grassroots, and it's groups like Catholic Vote that work more with the grassroots that help elect the senators and also people like President Trump, who got to nominate three pro-life judges who viewed the Constitution as being pro-life and saw no right to abortion in the Constitution. Without Donald Trump in there and without senators to back him up who agreed the same that life needs to be protected, we would not be where we are today.
Yeah. And for people who argue about his legacy, I would say that is his greatest legacy, in my opinion. He's done a lot of different things, but foremost for me is the implementation of the pro-life judges. I mean, he gave the pro-life movement the biggest gift they've probably ever received with those judges that eventually ended up striking down Roe v. Wade and putting us
right
in this position.
And while he might be remembered, and he's certainly being talked about currently on other issues within his administration, but I agree with you that he did something that since 1973 no other president has been able to do, and that's actually appoint judges who will uphold the law and overturn bad law being Roe v. Wade.
Yes, I completely agree. And Tom, you know, everyone in DC calls themselves an expert, but I think you have actually earned the title. Always appreciate getting to talk, and hopefully we'll have you on more episodes.
I enjoy that. Thanks.
So on to the next story, Yelp targets charities. Now, we're not just talking about any old charities. We're talking about pregnancy resource centers. So specifically, this story is Yelp is adding a warning label on pregnancy resource centers that these centers are arguing are meant to scare women away from receiving help. And I think to add context, it helps to know what the exact warning label is. So anytime you search a crisis pregnancy center on there, they'll slap a label on top that says exactly this. This is a crisis pregnancy center. Crisis pregnancy centers typically provide limited medical services and may not have licensed medical professionals on site.
I mean, you could say that same thing about
abortion parenthood. Clinics.
What are we doing here? Like, no medical center has every licensed medical professional. If you go to a heart surgeon and you ask to get foot surgery, they're not going to treat you. So you can put that label on all medical places everywhere. So why now all of a sudden are we targeting these pregnancy resource centers? They've been around. They've been around for 50 plus years. I don't know the exact start, but definitely before the Roe v. Wade decision came down. So,
I mean, it's pretty clearly this is bigotry. Yeah. Dobbs changed. Now they have to find a target. They got to go after this. It's, and I think I said this to you earlier, Tom, it's ignorance at best. They're just, you know, listening to Elizabeth Warren and she's dictating to them what all their greatest fears should be, or it's malice at worst. And the irony to me was that this is the same week that this poll came out in the Federalist. We covered that the majority of Americans, including Democrats, think that we should support pregnancy resource centers. They don't prefer to be called crisis pregnancy centers, by the way. If you asked any one of them, they would rather be. So if they want to self-identify, these are pregnancy resource centers. But most Americans think that we should even be using taxpayer dollars to support these charities because of the good work that they do. So for Yelp, which is a major resource for a lot of Americans to find services and, you know, restaurants, and I go there to find best fried chicken in the city I'm in, for them to slap this on, it's offensive, it's bigoted, and they ought to take it down. They should be ashamed of themselves.
But you're right, though. They're following the cues. You know, it's just another big tech liberal company following the cues of the far left. And Elizabeth Warren, so far out of the mainstream, as you mentioned, two-thirds of Americans think we should fund these pregnancy resource centers. But Elizabeth Warren's out there with legislation to try to shut them all down, have the Federal Trade Commission shut them down as if they're, you know, deceiving people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like my friend said it really good. Okay, her contention is, oh, you're looking to get an abortion. And these people talk to you and say, hey, I have some help here for you. We have diapers. We have formula. We can help you with your baby. And so she's saying that's deceptive. It's torturing women. That was her words. And she wants to shut them down. And the point is, she's considering it like fraud. And my friend said, well, actually, it's almost like, you know, a suicide prevention network. Like if someone was Googling how to kill themselves, and mm-hmm. a website came up and said, actually, here, I got information about suicide. And you start reading it, and it turns out they tell you how many people regret, thought about doing suicide, but then changed their mind and how it affected people. And after you read it, you're like, and we can help you. And you decide not to kill yourself. Like, is that deceptive?
Really good point. Right.
Maybe it's deceptive. We're trying to save lives. Like, it's not deception. It's like, you know, you're in a state of concern, and you know whether it's you didn't expect to get pregnant, or you're somebody who's feeling in desperation, like suicide. These are situations where people are trying to help you and mm-hmm. trying to save lives. Like, so to consider it torture or deception is just horrible. And Yelp is playing along with it, as you say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The scariest thing to me is Yelp is not the only place that's considered this. I know that the New York Attorney General has directly ask Google to slap labels on Google searches as well. So I think this is why people get really frustrated with big tech. It's so one-sided here. It's so hard for me to find an angle where we would be mad at people volunteering time and volunteering money to help women in a tough situation. Like being in an unplanned pregnancy is a really tough situation. You need the support. People want to provide the support. And we have these government officials colluding with tech companies. It's the same thing with Twitter that we're all coming out now that there's been all this. The issue is when you have a private entity and they are in direct contact with the government and the government is telling them, hey, you have to do this, knowing that most people on there as a de facto town square, that's collusion. I don't know the right word for it, but it is illegal. Like that's not a capitalistic society at the very least. It sounds more CCP.
Well, it's kind of funny, though, like these big tech companies come up with these great, you know, innovations like Facebook. Here's an opportunity for you to, you know, connect with friends, coworkers, the person you went to college with, family, friends, all that kind of stuff. That's great.
It's a great service. Yeah.
And Yelp, here's the thing where, you know, you can leave a review of a pizza place and all this other stuff. Now, conservatives, pro-lifers, don't look at Yelp and say, let's shut down all reviews or put warning labels. This place kills people. We're not calling on that. We're just saying, here, you created this resource. We would like equal footing. We don't want to be targeted. Like, that's not that crazy. But the left wants to weaponize everything. They want mm-hmm. banks to say, don't do loans to, you know, the NRA or guns manufacturers. Don't have bank accounts available for coal companies. You know, don't, let's slap warning labels on pregnancy research centers. They want to, it's not just that they want the government to take over so many industries, which increasingly they want. It's that they're okay with freedom or the marketplace so long as it's on their terms and conditions, right? And those terms and conditions are, well, your freedom's good insofar as it doesn't interfere with our social agenda. And, you know, in this case, they ragged on pro-lifers for so long. Like, you don't care about the baby after it's born. We open up thousands of pregnancy resource centers, and what do they want to do? They want to shut them down.
Right.
And therefore, it's no freedom at all.
Catholics and, you know, people who do support these resource centers, it's important to think of creative ways around the obvious big tech solutions for getting the word out that they exist and what they do as well. And it just, I mean, my parents helped found a resource center up in our hometown when I was a kid, and they've had to spend a lot of time with one-on-one in-person meetings, talking to people who have connections with women who are actually vulnerable in the community, because they can't rely on the Facebook page. They can't rely on social media as the means of getting the word out and serving the women that they want to serve. And that's been a real struggle in a lot of ways. I mean, even the local town newspaper doesn't want to run ads on them anymore, right? It's like, it's this trickle down effect. It's this trickle down
money.
Yeah, right. It's like, you can't even they could advertise, I think, if they really were just like, no, we want to cut you the check, but they won't do a profile piece.
To Erica, wouldn't we call that like systemic, right? It's not racism.
Did you say the S word? Yeah, it's systemic. Right.
This is what I'm saying. Like, this has been my battle cry for 20 years. We need to create our own institutions,
our own systems.
Not just complain about the media, be the media. And that means
a loop.
Yeah. No, seriously. Right. If you're wondering why we back up all of our stuff, because we could get yanked from social media tomorrow because we have the wrong opinion on pregnancy resource centers or whatever. Do you think we go through email? Why do you think we're developing?
I mean, Tom,
app?
We have been temporarily suspended from Twitter already at one time, and then. There's three different banks have told us they don't want to do business with us, or, you know, so, I mean, we get this stuff. It happens.
Right. We have to be selective with our contractors. Like, but the reason why we're so adamant about we need multiple ways to get the loop to people is because if we hold one of these wrong think opinions, then we could just be wiped off of all of these things. So yes, 100%. I believe in building parallel institutions. That's why I think what they're doing at the Daily Wire is so cool. Their mission's awesome. That's why I love seeing what's going on with Hillsdale College. They're not taking any government money. I love seeing what's going on. St. Joseph the Worker is going on. These trade schools mixed with
a lot of good things.
Yeah, exactly. So these.
Yeah, and just to be clear, like, I'm not saying we shouldn't fight for a more equitable. And listen to me saying equitable. We shouldn't fight for a more equitable Yelp, right? Or a more equitable Facebook or Google or Twitter. Because I think that those big tech institutions, that sort of legacy media, whatever, CNN, they should be held accountable for being so bigoted and marginalizing people of certain worldviews. They should be, absolutely. But at the same time, we want to continue doing good work. We don't want to wait around for someone to save us from Yelp. 100%. Like, let's find our own systems. Grow chickens in your backyard too. Grow your own eggs. I'm not going to pay for eggs. I'm going to grow my own eggs.
No way. Absolutely. grow our own Catholic eggs.
Catholic eggs. Catholic chickens. All chickens are Catholic, Tom. Sorry.
Oh my man. Wait, can chickens cry? Can chickens?
They do when they see me.
And that brings us to my favorite segment of every week. That is the Twilight Zone. We're back, baby. Mercer, you were up first. What was your Twilight Zone moment of the week?
The death of ultra-liberal Bishop Weakland from Milwaukee. He died at age 95. So that's on its own, it's not weird. I mean, he's 95 years old. Mm-hmm. This was a hyper-leftist bishop. You know, when he retired, it was a relief to the faithful of Milwaukee. It later came out that he himself was embroiled in a sex abuse scandal. He was paying money, hundreds of thousands of bucks of the church money, to somebody who he had been involved with in massive scandal. And so when we had the news of his death this week, Father James Martin was just out there running cover for him. And Father James Martin, of course, he's the celebrity priest on Stephen Colbert's show. And Father James Martin is very pro-gay and pro-trans. And he thinks the church is totally out of touch on all that stuff. And so he saw an opportunity. He needs to defend this guy who was totally heterodox in all church teachings on human sexuality. But it's like, why are you, I mean, hello, like sometimes you just got to let something go. This guy was involved in sex abuse himself. Like, don't touch it. Leave it alone. Mm-hmm. Father James Martin could have just said complicated history, you know, rest in peace, pray for his soul, whatever. And everyone would have been like, okay, fine. But he's out there sending tweets, like trying to defend him. And it's like completely, you know, and then some people are like, dude, the guy was downright scandalously sinful, publicly so, public scandal. Like, and then Father James replied, well, you know, aren't we all sinners? Like, I mean,
aren't any of your friends sinners?
Sure, all sinners, but not all of us are engaged in public scandal or holding major office and using hush money. I mean, are you kidding me?
Like, backpedal. Come on, man.
Oh, he did. He had to backpedal.
Which he did. He did backpedal.
Well, that was a part of his apology. His apology was, first apology was, yeah, I know, but like, don't you know, do you have any friends who have sinned before as kind of a gotcha?
That's what I'm saying.
The magic of Twitter is Ratio City. It was like instantly quote tweeted, like way more, like it was insane. Like people picked it up. Breitbart wrote an article about it. And then, I mean, eventually he got around to a second apology, which is like, you know, I'm sorry. Like, I know he's involved in the scandal. I probably shouldn't have been propping him up. But I feel like this is kind of the thing with Father James Martin, right? Is he knows the buttons to push. He knows the games to play. Yeah, sure. Eventually he'll apologize, but the damage has been done.
Well, I mean, sometimes he does that. Sometimes I think he's intentionally provocative to stir things up. Is that what's going on in this case? Maybe. Or he's just looking at someone who was truly his friend, right? And was just like him campaigning against church teaching human sexuality for decades and decades. And he misses him. He's like, oh, too bad. I'm so sorry to hear this. Because he considers him a brother in arms. Whereas I think of him as someone, even before I heard of any scandal, I thought this guy is himself a scandal because he was an archbishop undermining the church at every turn. And, you know, he was horrible, right? Mm-hmm. And he was causing people to lose faithfulness in their church. And so it's like, I think he was wicked before I knew about all that stuff. When someone was so bad at what he's doing, dies, I'm like, oh, well, you know, pray for him, sure.
Right.
But, you know, but again, Father James Martin comes from the standpoint of, what a great guy anyway. Oh, yeah, I guess he sinned a little bit. Well, have you sinned? And it's like, dude, no, category difference here. Way worse than that. Stop apologizing for that. He's like, oh, yeah, I guess so. My bad.
Right. I mean, I think the lesson here, Father James Martin, the only appropriate response to the death of a churchman who has had this questionable at best past is, Lord have mercy on his soul. I will say a mass for him. Yeah. Done. No more. Simple. Zip.
Hey, you should apply for his PR team.
It's good.
I think he needs
a PR.
Oh boy.
Father James Martin's PR.
I think we all agree he should tweet less and talk less, period.
So, Erica, I know you have a Twilight Zone you've been sitting on for the week.
Okay. So this was my Twilight Zone moment. And it's actually just sort of like, oh, cute, naive Erica moment. But we all know Fauci announced his retirement, right? And everyone's like, yay, there's lots of aplomb and applause.
So a lot of people are terrified, actually, because science retired. When people heard science retired,
I'm sorry, right. So my condolences to anyone who's concerned by this news. However, Fauci retires. I'm listening to somebody talk about it somewhere, and they're like, at 81, Fauci is looking for... And I was like, wait, hold the phone. Fauci is 81? I had no idea the guy was so old. So I'm like looking him up. I mean, he's been in career for 50 years, and he's like, I'm looking forward to the next phase of my career. I'm like, no. Like, the only appropriate thing for an 81-year-old to do is... to go prepare to meet God, right? Like, or spend time well, with your family, or
retirement, for crying out loud.
Just
you're
enjoy
not
life.
Gonna die, right?
But I know he's
like, go
he's
fish got or something. Money, like,
enjoy right. life. I'm just
hop
like,
on a boat, go fish.
He's in the same bank as like Nancy Pelosi. She's 82. Like, please retire, Nancy. Yeah. Enjoy life, Biden. I mean,
octogenarians, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Octogenarians running our country. It's like we're in Germany in the 1930s with the Kaiser. Like, come on, guys, we got to get some new blood in there and not what Germany came up with, right? So, like,
let's find a new solution.
Let's try a better solution.
Badanalogies.com, but okay.
I know. Sorry. That was not, I mean, like, we don't want to be Germany in 1930. Okay, this is what got them into that.
It's the opposite, though, of like 1960. Yeah. Like, you know. Democrats like, we don't need this old geezer Eisenhower. Yeah. We need fresh blood of Kennedy. John Kennedy. This would be great. You know, and that generation stuck around for a while, and then the boomers
and they're still here, apparently.
They will never leave.
Fauci was campaigning for Kennedy.
Wouldn't it be nice to have like a, you know, constitutional amendment? Like, you have to be 25 to serve in Congress. You have to be 30 to serve in the Senate. You have to be 35 to be president. What if we had a maximum age, too?
Absolutely.
Like, 80 is enough.
That's
right?
It's enough. Yeah. You have
and
served
like,
your country long enough.
You're 80 years old. You can, you know, you're done. You're done.
For all the people that are going to come on this and be like, well, when Trump runs, he's going to be around that. I'm completely comfortable with conceding Trump at this point. Like, if you're 80, golf. Like, I know that's what Trump, you love to golf. Like, golf time. Like,
please.
I would love to see someone a little bit younger than 80 years old.
And the rules would apply to everybody.
Yes, I'm fine.
Equal,
I'll concede it.
Equal under the law.
Yes. I mean, my biggest giveaway that Fauci was a little too old was watching him throw out the first pitch at the Nationals game. Wow, that was a bad throw. It was almost like hard to watch, you know? Like, it was like the 50 cent throw back in the day. It's tough. I was like, this guy, he's not holding up well. He can't throw it.
Like, there's supermodels that could throw a baseball faster than him. <That's terrible. laughs>
Yeah,
I think we should stop going down this road.
Yeah, it might be time to swerve over to.
That's swerve.
Yeah, my
what was,
time
what was your moment,
over.
Tom? What was Tom's Twilight Zone moment?
Tom's Twilight Zone, and you know, this is kind of the joys of the job, right? Because I'm kind of scouring the internet for some videos to bring to the audience. Boy, oh boy, did I find some gold! I found like three back to back to back, but one of the three that I found was Stacey. Is it Stacey Abrams or is Stacey Abrams? Right, that's how you connect.
Mm-hmm.
Pronounce it. Stacey Abrams, in a Protestant church, which, you know, Protestant churches, you can kind of tell they have a very distinct nothingness to them. And she's in this church and she's giving a speech.
I am the daughter of two pastors. I have a strong moral core. I was trained to read and understand the Bible. And I will tell you this, there is nothing about the decision to eliminate access to abortion care that is grounded in anything other than cruelty and meanness and danger in the state of Georgia. Nothing. Abortion care is a medical issue. It is a medical decision, and in the state of Georgia, it is a dangerous one. Brian Kemp, and yes, I'm gonna call his name, is a hard right religious extremist who has decided that he knows better than any woman about her body, and has decided to make women second-class citizens in the state of Georgia in the year of our Lord, 2022.
She's in a church. And it just feels like when you're in a church, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a cathedral, but it's still a church, place of worship. To be that disrespectful in a church felt wrong. And then it also feels so wrong when she basically took people sincerely held beliefs that in a pro-life and that all human life has dignity, and maybe some Bible passages like thou shalt not kill and things like that, and turned it all on its head and said, no, actually, not only are those people who have those sincerely held beliefs wrong, I'm right. And if you believe those things, you're an extremist and evil. It just reminds me of like, it's so twisted. It's twisted and
it's totally twisted.
Wrong. It's insulting to me and people who sincerely hold a pro-life position. And this is all in a church. And she's supposed to be holding this guise of some
as
type
a Christian.
Of religious. Yeah, as a Christian. So,
I mean, as a Bible-believing Christian, she's saying, she's co-opting that title and turning it around completely the opposite, right? So she's saying, I'm the Christian here, and you all are the, you know, she doesn't use the word, but like the pagans and the barbarian hordes out there in the extreme fringes of society. Whereas in the whole Christian tradition, of course, the defense of the weakest among us, including the unborn, including infant girls in ancient Rome, including, you know, women and girls in the Indian reservations, it has always been the purview of the Christian faith to care for them. So I think that, yeah, the Twilight Zone-ness of it was just sort of the, I mean, this was just it's this audacious co-opting of the terminology. And there's something very visceral when, you know, someone who's clearly a man walks into your woman's changing room in the YMCA and says, no, I'm a woman. Or when someone who is clearly holding this anti-Christian view of, you know, we ought to be able to dismember our children in the womb, and women can only be women if they haven't, if they can kill their children legally. And that's Christian. It's the same kind of just, it gives you a gut punch because language does matter. And for someone to just, you know, rape your language like that, it's really unsettling and Twilight Zone. Yes. Yeah.
Not chill.
Totally. Not chill. No cap. Well. No cap.
yeah, that about wraps us up for this week. Thank you all for joining. Really appreciate it. Really enjoy kicking these out for you. I guess we'll see Keep you guys next time. Keep it real. Bye.
Thanks for joining us on Loopcast. Please subscribe and leave a review.